We're very pleased at this time to begin a study of the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel was a prophet who prophesied during the Babylonian captivity. He was carried to Babylon in 597 B.C., 11 years before Jerusalem was destroyed. And just to kind of refresh our memory, let's notice that the Assyrian captivity of Israel to the north had been some 120 years earlier. In 734 B.C., Galilee and north and east Israel were carried off by Tiglath-Pileser. In 721 B.C., Samaria and the rest of Israel by Sargon. And in 701 B.C., 200,000 of the inhabitants of Judah were carried by Sennacherib. But in 606 B.C., the Babylonian captivity of Judah was begun. In that year, the first captives were taken to Babylon, and among that group was Daniel. In 597 B.C., some 9 years later, more captives were taken to Babylon, and this time Ezekiel was taken, and he went with the king Jehoiachin. Then in 586 B.C., Jerusalem was finally burned, and the bulk of the rest of the people were taken into Babylonian captivity. And this was during the reign of King Zedekiah. The captivity lasted for 70 years, from 606 B.C. to 536. Ezekiel was there from 597 B.C. to at least 570 B.C. So Ezekiel's prophecy is given while he is in Babylonian captivity. The chief scene of his ministry was in Tel Abib in northern Mesopotamia on the river Sheber, along the banks of which were the settlements of the exiles. He was probably born in or near Jerusalem, where he must certainly have lived for many years. The date of his having entered upon the prophetical office is given in the first chapter in the first verse, and it is very likely that he entered upon this office at the legal age of 30, which means that he did not function as a priest while in Jerusalem. But as his father was a priest, he was no doubt brought up in the courts of the temple and so became familiar with its services and arrangements. Ezekiel lived in a house of his own, was married, but he lost his wife in the ninth year of his exile. Of the rest of his life, we know very little or nothing. He lived and prophesied during the time of Daniel and Jeremiah. Daniel had been in Babylon 9 years when Ezekiel arrived. Now, at this time, Daniel had already attained a great fame. He was in the palace. He was among the more elite people of the nation, whereas Ezekiel was in the country, and he was primarily among his own countrymen. They may have met, they may have been acquainted with each other, although the scripture does not specifically say that. However, we think that it would have been most difficult for them to have not been acquainted with each other and to have conversed and exchanged ideas. Jeremiah also lived during the time of Ezekiel. Jeremiah was older. He was a prophet at Jerusalem. Ezekiel may have been one of his pupils. But at the time of Ezekiel's prophecy, we find that Jeremiah was prophesying at Jerusalem. He was preaching at Jerusalem, and his ministry was directed to those people who had not yet been taken into captivity. He was warning them. He was pleading with them to follow the right course to prevent the captivity, whereas Ezekiel's prophecy was to the people who were already taken into captivity. He was in Babylon, and he was warning and pleading with those people to do the right thing so their captivity would be brought to an end or so their life would be made more tolerable. So Jeremiah, to the people before their captivity, while still at Jerusalem, Ezekiel, to people who had already been taken into captivity during that time, while in Babylon. No doubt, much of Jeremiah's message arrived for Ezekiel to learn of, and vice versa. Ezekiel's message made it back to Jerusalem. We also find that many of the things that Ezekiel says are very closely connected to statements given in the book of Revelation by John. For example, they both talk of the cherubim. That's Ezekiel 1 and Revelation 4. Gog and Magog, Ezekiel 38 and Revelation 20. Eating the book, Ezekiel 3, Revelation 10. The New Jerusalem, Ezekiel 40 through 48 and Revelation 21. The river of water of life, Ezekiel 47 and Revelation 22. So we will learn that much of the writings of Ezekiel then are not only for the benefit of those people in captivity and the prediction of the events that are going to happen to God's people, Judah, in and after the captivity, but they also apply to a greater extent to the time of the Messiah, the time of the church, the Christian age, which happens to be the very age that we live in now. So they're very relevant to our situation today. The lessons taught therein, the great principles that are brought forth, are ageless, and they do apply to us also. The name Ezekiel means God strengtheneth or hardeneth. The period during which Ezekiel prophesied in Chaldea, during the Babylonian captivity, was signalized, one, by the miserable reign of Zedekiah, ending in his imprisonment and death in Jerusalem, two, by the destruction of the temple, the sack of Jerusalem, and the final deportation of its inhabitants, and three, by Gedaliah's short regency over the poor remnant left behind in the country, his treacherous murder, and the flight of the conspirators, and during this flight they took with them Jeremiah into Egypt, and four, by Nebuchadnezzar's conquest in the neighboring countries, and especially his prolonged siege of Tyre. As we study in this prophecy, and in other prophecies, we can see how that the events of the great nations round about are closely intertwined with God's plan for His people. So that God is the ruler over these governments. He makes the decisions as to what's going to happen to them. He sets them in power. He takes them out of power. And they are simply tools in His hand to bring about His will here on this earth. So having a good knowledge of the history of the times is of a great benefit in making a proper application of many of these prophecies. This book of Ezekiel throws much light upon the condition and the feelings of the Jews, both in the Holy Land and in exile, and upon the relation of the two parties to each other. Now let's bear in mind now we have two groups of Jews. One group is still in Jerusalem. They have not yet been carried into captivity. They are feeling that God's not going to let this happen to them. They are feeling that they're going to be safe. They have false prophets who rise up and try to convince them that everything's going to be all right, that they're not going to be carried into captivity. And here Jeremiah, among that group, is trying to convince them that they will be destroyed, they will fall, that they must repent, they must turn from idolatry, and he's looked upon as some kind of a traitor. Whereas the other group that's already been taken into captivity, they are being deceived into thinking that their captivity is going to be shortened, that it's all just very, very temporary. And so Ezekiel is trying to convince them that the captivity is very real and it has not been promised that it'll be shortened, but that they must make some repenting, they must make some changes before they'll ever be allowed to go back to Jerusalem. So both prophets are giving essentially the same message, Jeremiah is much more mournful than Ezekiel. They're both giving the same message, though, to two different groups of people. And these people then also have a feeling toward each other. The ones in Jerusalem begin to look down upon the exiles as though they are a lesser type people. And it's the duty of Ezekiel and Jeremiah to persuade them that that's not true at all, that God's true sentiments are going to be with the exiles. The ones who are still in Jerusalem are going to eventually fall, and the exiles will eventually be allowed to come back then to Jerusalem. But during this time, Idolatry remained in Jerusalem, even among the priests and in the temple. And it clung to the exiles also, though it was probably to a less degree. Mixed up with this unfaithfulness to the true God was this prevalent superstitious confidence that God would protect them and that God would not allow anything bad to happen to them. And they were utterly disregarding the conditional character of His promises. Now, all these promises that are given about them living in Canaan and being allowed to live there and dwell there are conditional promises, conditioned upon the fact that they're going to be faithful and that they're not going to have idolatry. And they neglect that feature of His promises, the fact that there's a condition there. We today must realize that all the promises He's given us in the New Testament age are also conditional. They're based upon the fact of our continuing faithful and unmovable in the doctrine of Christ. And whenever we neglect that condition and we just assume that these promises are going to be given to us regardless, then we're making the same mistake that these people made back during the time of Ezekiel and Jeremiah. So while the people still in Jerusalem felt some superiority toward their fellow countrymen who were in captivity, they even began to despise them and to feel like that they were not truly God's people, Ezekiel's job was to convince the exiles that to them, and not to the Jews in Palestine, belonged the enduring title of God's people. Ezekiel's message was primarily to the people among whom he dwelt, those in captivity in Babylon. He had to convince them, number one, of God's utter abhorrence of idolatry, and of the sure and irrevocable doom of those who practiced it. Secondly, he had to show that the Chaldeans were the instruments of God. That is, their captors were really, in a sense, carrying out God's will. They were the instruments of God, and that, therefore, resistance to them was both hopeless and unlawful. They must not resist the Babylonians. And then he had to, thirdly, destroy the fact that they had confidence in external privileges, that they looked to temporal, physical blessings rather than to God's true divine promises. He had to show them the true character of the divine government and the ultimate purpose of it. And in showing this, he looks forward to that ultimate time when the Messiah comes and when His kingdom is established and the glorious age of the church. Ezekiel's task was indeed a bitter one. But personally, he soon acquired respect and attention. And if he was at first opposed, he was at last listened to, if not obeyed. He may have been instrumental together with Daniel in working that reformation in the Jewish people, which certainly was to some extent affected during the captivity. For we find that the Jewish people did learn the lesson about idolatry, and they eventually had no more idolatry among them. And while our Savior lived here upon this earth, we have no evidence that idolatry was practiced among the Jews. One of the immediate effects of the captivity was the reunion of the severed tribes of Israel. Remember, when the captivity first began among the nation to the north, God's people had been separated. The 10 tribes to the north actually were considered to be lost tribes. They were scattered among the heathen. But we find that the captivity was the thing that brought about the reunion of these tribes. But in Jeremiah 3:18, we find that he definitely prophesied that these tribes would be reunited during the captivity, or at least shortly after the captivity. He says in Jeremiah 3:18, "In those days the house of Judah shall walk with the house of Israel, and they shall come together out of the land of the north to the land that I have given for an inheritance unto your fathers." So when the captivity was over, those who went back to Jerusalem constituted the reuniting of the 12 tribes. Now probably the bulk of the 10 tribes to the north did waste away during the time of their captivity. They were scattered among the heathen and among the other nations. However, the remnant that did come back, and we find when we study in the book of of Ezra and of the book of Nehemiah that there is reference made to the other tribes of Israel coming back. So when they did make the return from captivity, this constituted the reuniting of these tribes. So we find Ezekiel using the terms Judah and Israel indiscriminately to those among whom he dwelt. And the sins of Israel, no less than those of Judah, are summed up in the reproof of his countrymen. All descendants of Abraham were again being drawn together as one people, and this was to be affected by the separated members gathering again around the legitimate center of government and of worship under the supremacy of Judah. Attempts have been made from time to time to discover the lost 10 tribes by persons expecting to find or thinking that they have found them existing still as a separate community. But according to what we learn about the captivity from Ezekiel and Jeremiah, the time of captivity was the time of reunion of these tribes. Ezekiel's mission was to the house of Israel, not only to those who came out with him from Jerusalem or Judah, but to those also of the stock whom he found residing in a foreign land where they had been settled for more than 100 years previous to his captivity. The book divides itself conveniently into four major sections. Chapters 1 through 24 tells us that Jerusalem must fall. Now, Ezekiel insisted that this must happen, and he gives 24 chapters talking about it. Secondly, chapters 25 through 32 tells us that the foreign nations must also fall. Then in chapter 33, he bridges the first 24 chapters with the last chapters, chapters 34 through 48. And then chapters 34 through 48 tells us that Jerusalem and its people must be comforted. Another thing about this book is that Ezekiel's visions, with minor exceptions, are given in chronological sequence. The years are dated from King Jehoiachin's captivity, which was 597 B.C. And the 30th year that we read of in the first verse of the first chapter was the equivalent of the 5th year of Jehoiachin's captivity. And this is thought to have been the 30th year of Ezekiel's life. This was the age at which the Levites began their service, and we feel that this is when Ezekiel began his service as a priest. Jesus and John the Baptist also began their work at the age of 30. The message of Ezekiel was especially important. Too many of the Jews were optimistic without reason. They refused to believe that Jerusalem would really go under. They refused to believe that the rulers on David's throne would be completely overthrown. And they refused to believe that the whole nation could be removed from off the land. But throughout the book, especially in chapters 1 through 24, we hear that the city and the temple are to be destroyed, that there will be a total national captivity, and that the house of David was to be overturned. The people hadn't paid attention to the punishment clauses that were given in the agreements they had made with God. It was given to Ezekiel in Babylon, and also it was given to Jeremiah in Judea, to convince the people of the totality of judgment. He must persuade them that such judgment is just, and he spends 24 chapters doing all that. The nations round about Israel had something to smile about. The fall of Judah. How they hated her. How they used her when it was convenient. And how they despised the notion of the righteous Jews that Jehovah was the only true God. What now of the almighty righteousness and power of Jehovah? What now of his caring for the people? Had he been all-powerful and a lover of his people, he would have never let them fall and be carried away into captivity. But Ezekiel takes 8 chapters to tell these other nations that their day is coming too, and at the hands of the Jehovah they now despised. The God of the Jews had his strange way of working, which involved pain for his people because of their sins. If he would not tolerate sin in his people, he tolerated no more in foreigners who maligned his name. He would judge them, The foreigners would learn that just this Jehovah is holy and is truly the universal deity. And Ezekiel spends chapters 25 through 32 on that matter. Then, after chapter 33, when the nation is sunk into despair, God gives Ezekiel a message he must have enjoyed. Jerusalem must be comforted. The prophet spends 15 chapters telling that story. He will tell them of the government of the future, the land of the future, the enemies of the future, and the worship of the future. And that extended promise, and then future glory, eats up chapters 34 through 48. The arguments are still being made as to whether or not the prophet actually memed out the things spoken of in this book. You see, he had a very unique method of delivering his message. Did he see himself do it in a vision, or did he actually carry them out himself except where otherwise specified? And, of course, whatever conclusion you draw, it doesn't affect the message. But you'll have to agree that the prophet has an unusual approach. From building forts to boiling cauldrons, from weighing his shorn hair to eating his food with great quaking of the body, from acting out the part of a slow-trudging exile to an active man with a whirling sword, the message moves along swiftly. So we'll conclude at this time with these remarks for an introduction, and next time then we'll begin with the first verse of the first chapter of Ezekiel. Thank you.